Okay, it's back on.
Yeah. It was an anomaly. I mean, even people who studied protein kinase and were very excited about it, I'm absolutely convinced they were excited about it because of formal esters,
right.
Not because of diacylglycerol. And actually, very few people have studied diacylglycerol as the molecule on its own, in its own right.
Because it's so...
It's a lipid, it's difficult to work with, and people haven't made that, you know, the realization that, hey, maybe these lipids are there not just as building blocks for the membrane of the cell, but that a lot of information is being passed through lipids. And that has become now, currently, is our sort of central thesis, that lipids are really a ton load of, they carry just tons of information, and that's primarily their raison d'etre, is to transmit information as relays of information. But back then, diacylglycerol was considered, you know, as an exception, or, you know, an N of one. So with sphingosine, actually, when I first told Bob Bell that, hey, what about sphingosine doing that? He said, he was just as skeptical as he was with diacylglycerol and protein kinase C. And only after a few months, when I had a lot of data showing that sphingosine really inhibited PK, how it inhibited in cells, and actually one of his students who was a sphingolipid biochemist had picked up on that, Alfred Merrill. I discussed that with him, and he picked up on that and actually came with his own study at that time. Mm-hmm. Bob started becoming very interested about it. And at that time, I think it became clear that these lipids are more active molecules than just metabolically.
Sure.
And now you ask me a question about why is it not intuitive. I think now we can say it's very intuitive. And actually, you want to take a molecule like diacylglycerol if you were designing cell function and cell communication and signaling events. You want to take a molecule like diacylglycerol that's at the heart of so many metabolic pathways and use it also as a signal. Because by this way you make a very solid interface between a metabolic function and a signaling function.
As a matter of fact, as it's functioning in its metabolic way, that's its changes and the way it changes other things is going to be the signals, right? I mean, it's in a sense it's not doing two things; it's doing one thing, but of course it has a dual function.
It has a dual function. It's in one way.
Maybe I'm just being kind of
Maybe I should explain that in a metabolic sense, the old metabolic sense, diacylglycerol was the building block to make other phospholipids. In the signaling function, now totally dissociated from the metabolic function, it's a signal. If cells generate diacylglycerol, that's a signal to activate protein kinase C.
But it's also going to
it's also going
to diacylglycerol to do its lipid or its typical old metabolic
function. Now, I would
function.
Still think currently, if you want to say dogma, I mean, that's a funny thing about science, which I never understand, is after being around for 2 years, things become dogma,
I actually find it really very interesting.
It is very amazing. It's probably a tendency on scientists' part to simplify knowledge, processing of knowledge,
or to communicate it
and
to
communication of knowledge, because there's so much of it going on.
So much.
I think dogma now would have it that these are more distinct, separated events.
Oh,
that diacylglycerol is a precursor to lipids, that's one function, and it's a signaling molecule, that's another function.
So in an evolutionary sense, or in a gross cell biological sense, why does it have, what's the order perhaps of it having
a,
I mean,
oh, that's a good question. I would think in an evolutionary sense, perhaps the metabolic function came first, and then evolution would say, hey, this is a neat molecule to carry a signal through.
It's so central or so
it's central,
busy,
it's
changing and conforming.
And if you want, I mean, if you look at in terms of signal, it's something that you want to reprogram cells with. That's what a signal ultimately does. So you can obviously give it a kinase as a target, but also by changing all other phospholipids, you're reprogramming cells too. So you may want to take a molecule that's already at the heart of one metabolic function and give it another signaling function. That's almost philosophy of science at this point. But in terms of my working, I mean, I could always, not always, but I mean, I always find myself that I'm very good at painting a big picture. You know, 80% of the time turns out to be wrong. You know, that's the way science works. But and that's sort of what I took with me when I left Bob. Well, before I left Bob, since I got my physician scientist, I took more formal training in science. I attended coursework and I started doing some molecular biology projects on my own, cloning techniques, because obviously it became apparent that you can do serious cell biology and molecular biology if one didn't have the techniques and tools of DNA work and RNA work. So I sort of taught myself on my own those techniques while with Bob. And I was very comfortable in my productivity because I had a technician working with me at that time, and I could generate a lot of data on my enzymology and mixed micelles and whatnot, while at the same time freeing myself up to do other things.
And that was, in a sense, your own money. I mean, and right, that you had got, this is by the time you had gotten that grant. So even though you were in
Bob's lab
and using the space, I mean, really.
Well, I'm sure he supported the research with his money. I mean, my money didn't go far in terms of supporting research beyond my salary and a part-time technician.
You know, okay, you know, can maybe just for the record, I probably it's very easy to find what the pay was, what the the grant was worth for over 5 years.
I think the grant was somewhere around $60,000, maybe close to $300,000 over the 5 years, which covered mostly. but I mean, that's 5 years, and that covered mostly my salary, some of a technician's salary, and some supply money. And actually, it was structured in sort of two phases. The first phase, 2 years, would pay mostly my salary, and the third through fifth would pay for additional technician support and some supply support. So it got a little better.
But perhaps, although geared specifically toward MDs, with this kind of developmental sort of thing, this idea that, okay, you'll be in someone's lab, there'll be support there, but here's this, I guess some people call it hump money or whatever, you know, I mean, it's to get you over the, and to build you up so that you can,
it's
a great program, but I guess it, you know.
It's a brilliant program, this physician scientist.
This is NIH.
NIH. Okay. NIH.
It was, believe some of your colleagues, your MD colleagues, did it too, and that's how they are.
I think it was designed, I think, by Weingarten, James Weingarten, who was chairman of medicine at Duke and went on to become head of NIH. Yeah. And I think he designed that. And I think that's one of the more successful programs at NIH. It has a very well-designated target group, and it really accomplishes its goals with that target group, because it allows physicians to commit to a career in research without having to worry about funding, you know, a five-year grant, and allows them to become, you know, junior faculty once they get it, allows them to train, keep on training, and it really covers that transition period, because most physicians would get it after having spent sometime anywhere from a few months to a couple of years in the lab, and instead of trying to set up something on their own and then fall on their face, it gives them this transition. So that was, I mean, to me that was obviously a blessing, because if I didn't get it back then, one, I would have been probably very disappointed. You know, I didn't have that sort of patience with science back then, at least with a career in science back then. No, I wasn't very sure.
You'd have walked away, maybe.
I may have walked away, and it definitely made my next phase very secure. I just worried about science. That was it. So during that tenure of the physician scientist, that's when I was offered to stay here at Duke mm-hmm. as junior faculty and set up my own lab right here. Mm-hmm. And what I wanted to do back then is, my sort of strategic plan was to say, let's take these studies to a cellular level and define sort of pathways of cell regulation at the level of the cell, using my background in sort of enzymology, protein chemistry, lipid biochemistry, and more recently founded expertise, not I wouldn't say expertise, but familiarity with molecular biology. And that pretty much defines my program in science, my aspirations mm-hmm. in science. I want to discover and understand ways by which cells are regulated, focusing mostly now on cell growth and differentiation, and more recently cell death. Mm-hmm. The way I designed it is, designed the approach. Now, the tactical approaches is to have each student, pre-doctoral or post-doctoral, tackle an independent project that belonged to the big scheme. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the payoff has come in the last year or so, that these things have started to make sense, that they are really components of one story. Most of the projects in the lab came with the general question of this lipid question of signal transduction, asking the very basic, very naive question of the role of sphingolipids in signal transduction. By that time, it was becoming more obvious that phospholipids are involved in signal transduction beyond diacylglycerol, beyond PI, the PI cycle. People had started to make discoveries of other enzymes involved in signal transduction. Putting that with what had been known for a long time about arachidonic acid, another lipid coming from phospholipids, the paradigm became well established, dogma now, to elevate it to the status of dogma, that phospholipids participate in signal transduction. So what we wanted to do is ask the question about sphingolipids. Do sphingolipids participate in signal transduction processes? And that has been one of the overriding concerns in the lab, the major program in the lab. There is another program on protein kinase C in the lab, so I'll sort of never let go of protein kinase C. However, the questions became, again, more at the cellular level. At the biochemical level in the cell, it's sort of a funny niche, but what we've been after with protein kinase C is to try and ask questions and answer them in terms of how is this enzyme working in the cell at the molecular level in order to understand what function it serves. Now, let me put that in some perspective, because I could almost make a statement now that so far we don't know what any one protein kinase does in the cell. We have a lot of correlative evidence, we have a lot of ideas, but you come down to sort of very solid proof, you can almost not make any statement saying this protein kinase or this signaling molecule is really intimately responsible for that function. Almost cannot make that statement. It's sort of horrifying knowing how much signal transduction studies have mushroomed over the last 10 years. So our approach has been, well, let's move the in vitro studies, because that's not going to tell you about function. Let's move them to the cell, stick at the molecular level, and try to find out how one component really interacts mm-hmm. with the other in the cell, and figuring out how this can result in changes in function. Now, I would say it's only now, in the sort of, what now, fifth year of my work mm-hmm. as an independent person, on the protein kinase C side, that we are getting some rewards from this approach, that we are starting...
Getting rewards along the lines of the big...
Of the big picture. Of
answer that.
Well, not even the big picture itself at this point.
No, but
of establishing some important and new connections with protein kinase C at the molecular level that we hope will direct us to to function. And, you know, we have to, it's going to be tedious, it's going to be long, but I think it's going to be building it step by step at the molecular level in the context of the cell.
I guess maybe what I'd like to do is play devil's advocate a little bit, if I can, and actually maybe it's, I might even, there'll be a little more naive than devil's advocate kind of questions, so I'll just be, you know.
Go ahead.
Duh kind of questions. I get the sense that the biochemical approach that you use isn't just a matter of, okay, that's what I learned and I'm good at that and so I'll stick with it, but that you think it's the best way to answer some of these functional questions. Again, I'm not about cell biology and cells, not at a narrower level of genes and molecules and proteins and individual things like that, but the whole thing. And I was wondering what, you know, what your opinion was of, you know, perhaps more structural approaches, or, you know, more straight genetic approaches, or are they just something that you see as obstructive or taking you down into narrower areas, or is the competition doing it? And I'm trying to get a sense of a wider, you know, context in which you're doing this, and because you've been pretty steady with it. The biochemical.
Well, I mean, if that's the devil's advocate, I mean, we put ourselves to much more stringent questioning. Let me describe sort of where I stand on things. I mean, I come from the clinical side of things, and that always gives me a clinical perspective of things. It's very easy for me to see how something we do now could, if it works out in a certain direction, can have clinical significance. I'm not saying it will, I'm just saying how I can evaluate every item very easily along those lines. On the other hand, I think my training with Bob Bell on almost, I would say, an esoteric subject of lipid biochemistry, and having, I think, succeeded in that, has given me a lot of self-confidence that I can learn new things at a very basic and molecular level. And that's what I always, you know, tell my students they have to adopt as a policy, that tools are only tools. We're not a protein chemistry lab. We're not a biochemistry lab. We're after solving problems. I think you articulated that yourself pretty well. We are after solving problems irrespective of the tools. And in the course of the last few years, we have come across all kinds of techniques.
Yeah, I'm still kind of thinking back in like 89 and 90, as opposed to, you know, you look through this and there's a heck of a lot more, for instance, molecular genetics in the past.
We look at all these things as tools. If they help us get to answering those questions, fine. Now, what are the questions? I think that's where it's, you know, they get imprinted with my philosophy and my bias and whatnot. If I was a structural biochemist who was, you know, not only trained in X-ray crystallography but really loved the subject, you know, I would pose questions related to X-ray crystallography.
You obviously have enough familiarity with what goes on and why people ask structural questions and go at it from a structural point of view to perhaps at some point. I mean, you must sit there occasionally, and it crosses your mind. Now, what if, you know? What if we thought about its spatial relationship to all that stuff and all that? I mean, what you can do? I mean, you can do functional studies that are.
Well, I think, but I mean, that's where I think our lab may be a little unique. Maybe not unique is not the right word, but in a special group of labs, because we're not the very structural people like the people who do X-ray crystallography. on the single lipid side, I think before we started with the sphingosine story, believe me, it was 90% structural work with sphingolipids, all describing new structures and analyzing them and whatnot.
And not going anywhere, maybe, is what they are, not going not, as far as you did with
yeah.
the... Okay.
So, I think the way we are, I would like to think that we are special, is that we do think of what we're doing at sort of the three-dimensional molecular level. That's always something I encourage my students. Never work with a compound you don't have some visualization of what it looks like. Even your protein, just try to have an arbitrary image of that. Definitely your lipids, have a good understanding of that structurally and physical properties too. That's what obviously gives us an edge in studying lipids. But I think it's this ability to think about things in a molecular level and at the same time trying to push the whole system towards understanding very general biology questions of maybe more clinical relevance. Because you, if we did not have this clinical, or and when I say clinical relevant, it's not like I expect to have a drug next 5 years. I mean, it may be the next generation. Or maybe never. But in terms of providing these kinds of novel connections that alert people, hey, these may be targets for drugs, or these may allow us understanding of diseases, pathology, physiology. This is in this very global, generic clinical sense.
Sure.
A good sphingolipid chemist may just characterize the structure of the sphingolipid. A sphingolipid biochemist may want to understand how the enzyme works, you know. How does it take a sphingolipid and modify it and spit out a different sphingolipid and really become very sophisticated in that. I love that kind of science, but that's not what we're doing.
I would say that was part of what you were doing in preparation. I mean, I would think that, for instance, the one article I really concentrated on, the 89 Science one, you know, is almost a partially a review article, right? Or
yeah.
not, you know.
Oh, it is a review.
And
the one.
So there's, I mean, clearly a lot of that work came out of your own, you know, that was your own experimental work as well as your ability and your like, you know, one of the things you like to do, which is to read widely. I mean, that's it's a piece of work about, I think, those kind of all those incredibly subtle little.
Yeah.
How does that enzyme work?
Yeah.
Without maybe looking at.
Yeah.
And then putting it together.
Yeah. So let me give you an example.
Yeah.
We've discovered a couple of new enzymes in the lab. One is a sphingomyelinase. Now, I will definitely go after, we have already purified it, we're going to study it more, analyze it, understand the biochemistry of this enzyme. But I guess my overriding goal is, we're not trying to understand the enzyme just to understand it, like maybe a sphingolipid biochemist would do. Which is legitimate, which will provide new information and insight. We will still do that stuff because we can do molecular and enzymologic studies, mm-hmm. but the always looking for hints about, well, if we understand how it works, that how does that allow us to understand how the enzyme is regulated in the cell, and vice versa, so that we can place it in its physiologic context. And the same thing, we've developed much more because we have much better tools to study protein kinase C, is, again, we now have, for example, you mentioned structural, we are at a structural level with one of the isoenzymes. We have a domain of the enzyme that interacts with the actin cytoskeleton of the cell, with the matrix of the cell. So we've defined that interaction because we were after a physiologic substrate for this enzyme. And the molecular level, now we've narrowed it down to like 15 amino acids. And so, but it's not because our idea was to take the enzyme and chop it up into domains and understand how each domain works in the test tube and stay there. We want to understand how it works in terms of, can we pull out a physiologic real substrate for this enzyme so we can place it in its physiologic niche. We sort of, if you're putting the jigsaw puzzle of the cell, you know, you can take the piece of the puzzle and understand exactly how this piece is made of. Well, we only do that in so much as we can know how to fit it So that's always been an overriding concern about what we do in the lab. And I believe strongly that by understanding the structure of each jigsaw puzzle, you will be able to fit it best. So maybe that's the duality I'm trying to explain in the lab.
I think that's why
we are very molecular and structural. We do that so that we can place things where they fit, or that may be too ambitious and presumptuous. So we understand, or have a much better feel of how they could possibly fit. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, eukaryotic biology is so complicated. Mm-hmm. But to gain more insight into how these things fit in a global scheme. So it's this duality that I personally enjoy tremendously, mm-hmm. going back and forth, mm-hmm. saying, oh, did you do this structural study, you know, with ceramide, which is the second messenger we think we discovered, and ceramide, incidentally, you take the diacylglycerol from this chart, put ceramide in, take phospholipids out, put sphingolipids
in,
you have almost an analogous situation. You take ceramide, I mean, one of the questions we asked very early on, what about this structure? What's unique to this structure? And those kind of studies led us to find that a very closely related molecule called dihydrocerumide doesn't work. In fact, it almost does the opposite. So that gives us a much better sense of what ceramide does in the cell because its cousin doesn't work.
It also maybe says something about the the relationship of certain, you know,
lipids to each other.
But that they're doing opposite things, but they may have, you know, similar structures or parts. And yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
more theoretical or large.
You can see by doing sort of the mundane, mm-hmm. which is taking ceramide and doing many compounds that look like ceramide and trying to understand how they work. This is, I shouldn't say mundane. It's sort of the rigorous biochemistry. You could have that for its own sake. And a biochemist in a biochemistry department may be very happy just doing that for its own sake, and that would be considered a good contribution, even by me.
So you'd fund that. I mean, you brought this up like 3 or 4 times, so I think I'll jump in and we'll get back to this ceremony.
Yeah.
The reasons you've gone after it the way you have, but you'd sit on a study section and fund something that was just going to.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I would. I mean, I think different people have different contributions to science, and you know, we wouldn't be sitting here discussing sphingolipid and whatnot had people not spent 100 years figuring out sphingolipid structure and biochemistry. I mean, or for that matter, all other cell. I mean, you know, the usual cliche. We all stand on the shoulders of people who stand on other giants' shoulders, and I mean that's very true. But I think
The phrase has a wonderful history. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Maybe you'll tell me about that later.
Off the tape. I'll get in trouble if I talk about it on.
I'm just trying to give you a perspective of what kind of science we pursue and for what reason. So we are a very molecularly oriented lab, but we try to figure things in terms of biology. And we can work both ways. We can work the biochemistry or the molecular biology and move to the cell using that information, like finding out that dihydrocerumide doesn't work, or vice versa. Try to understand something about the biology and then move back, see if that allows us to understand the molecule better or the molecular interactions better in vitro, elaborate on that, move back to the cell and see how things work at that level. It's a very dynamic interaction, but that's really what excites me about science. And I think we've been quite lucky in both sides of the lab, the protein kinase C and the sphingolipid side, in that we are definitely on the sphingolipid side, we're sort of painting a very beautiful picture. Mm. On the protein kinase C, I think we have developed sophisticated insight that we can now paint a more detailed, I can start seeing a more detailed picture being painted because of that.
You prefaced a lot of this by saying that, you know, you'd like to think that your lab is its approach is special, you know, and that there aren't a lot of them doing it this way, or maybe this again the dual. You used the word dual, and I guess I used it too, so we're both using the word a lot, and that's fine.
I guess one, I'd ask you who else is doing it, and it doesn't have to be, maybe you're aware of other people not even in related field in the sense of they're not your competitors, or they could be doing, I don't know, transcription, but they're doing it in some way that's, you know, got this, I don't know what I would, what phrase are you, this extra thing added on to it or something, that the goals aren't just the what's produced from the lab and its papers, but perhaps the more general understanding of biology, and you know, beyond the one area you're working, you know, or not one area, the areas you're working in. I was getting, you know, that's kind of a two-part question. Who else do you see, you know, who would you pattern yourself after somebody else, or do you see somebody patterning, you know, themselves after you? I mean, is this something you talk about or make, well, you know, verbalize with, yeah, other people, or
I think I'm still
confused.
First too young and too junior to be patterned after.
Okay.
That's all that part. who do I pattern myself after?
Or who do you talk to about these sorts of things? Or do you, has it all been saved up for me? I mean.
Yeah. Well, I talk to my wife, sure, about things. We collaborate.
Sure.
She's a physician scientist too. Sure. I talk to myself quite a bit. About these things. I mean, that's sort of, I guess, you know, I hope I have my creative moments.
Sure.
And, but beyond just creativity, I mean, I talk to myself quite a bit. I analyze, you know, strategy, the tactics, individual day's results. I mean, at all levels, I'm involved in that. I don't think I consciously have a role model that,
right,
I pattern after.
I guess it was this, you know, you started saying unique, and then you kind of backed down from that and said,
yeah, I don't want to be presumptuous.
Okay, well, but you're not naming any others.
Yeah, but it's primarily either because of ignorance or because
you know there's other people out there.
Or because of, you know, not wanting to spend 10 minutes now going systematically over different areas of region saying, you know, these people do the same thing and these don't. I mean, if you take a rundown of people doing things around Duke, basic research, I think the more successful labs I can name have been, you know, mostly on the basic side of things, not really concentrating too much on the physiologic significance of those studies.
But on the kind of like, as you said, the cellular or the...
Yeah. But, you know, again, I mean, I should take that back. I mean, if we now incorporate all the people who do molecular genetics, I think these people are using the tools of molecular genetics to approach questions of physiology and biology. That's obvious. And that opens up a whole group of people for you right there. I think we are a little different because we're not much into molecular genetics. I mean, we use it as an occasional tool, but maybe we're a little special because we're now using lipids in the same context and maybe enzymes. Was there another component to your question?
Well, I think it was, I mean, I thought the second part was really more, again, if you could find somebody to compare with, you know, how that was, how the comparison worked, you know. Not just were there others and who were they, but, you know.
Okay.
I think, as you just said, you talk to yourself a lot, so I think this is maybe something you've really given some thought to. It's not just coming off the top of your head,
yeah,
you know, as we talk.
Right.
It's a pretty...
Yeah.
And I think, therefore, of course, it's very... I mean, I'm asking even you to drop names because somebody can maybe read this and then go and go check out what you have to say even 150 years from now and say, oh, there is this kind of sense of doing things a certain way that may be communicated, you know, even without, you know, even here at Duke.
I mean, you may have
two students who are now, you know, they've postdocs who've gone on and they are struggling new PIs and they've taken a lot of your...
Well, I mean, I think I'm still too junior. I mean, my students have hardly, you know, graduated,
sure,
or gone on. A couple of them have only. We do discuss these issues, sort of the philosophy of the lab and the approaches to experimental design at all levels, the general strategic within the lab. We actually take maybe once a year we take off a whole day and go for a sort of a retreat and discuss these issues. On one-to-one basis, I usually meet with my students at home, you know, over, you know, dinner and an evening and discuss, you know, their general strategies and goals rather than, you know, when I meet with them in the lab, which is on day-to-day basis, and go over the daily results. Mm-hmm. Or even every couple of months they present their month, you know, their achievements and problems over that perspective. I still meet with them on sort of for more general levels of discussion. But I think we haven't advanced to a point where some of the students have gone on with those ideas. I don't know even how seriously they will take them after they go with them. In terms of the other part of your question, I mean, we can drop a few names. I mean, Bob Lefkowitz is considered like the premier scientist, the most, you know, known scientist at Duke now. He's a person who's been studying adrenergic receptors from day one until now. And he's done the whole thing with them, the biochemistry and the molecular biology and the more biochemistry, more molecular biology. But I don't think, and you know, his work is superb. He has a large operation funded by the Hughes, internationally renowned as the premier scientist working with adrenergic receptor, and probably as one of very few premier scientists working in receptors in general. I mean, he's really in that group. I mean, you cannot mention signal transduction or receptors without talking about Bob Lefkowitz. But I can definitely say that Bob Lefkowitz has never had in his lab, maybe in his, in his subconscious, or even in his long-term goals he has, but definitely not in his lab, a program to study the physiologic level, significance of these studies at a physiologic level. Now, you could always say that if we understand how a drug binds to the receptor, you understand how it works. That's plenty of justification mm-hmm. for that great science for me. But he represents a group where he doesn't even want to invest in saying, well, do you make a transgene, let's say, with an adrenergic receptor and look at what happens to biology, or knock out the receptor and see what happens? Or are the receptors important in cardiac failure, heart failure, or are they important directly in hypertension? He's not looking at either total body or total cell system physiology. And the justification of his work, I mean, he doesn't need justification. No. So, but he represents that class of science. And I may represent more, now coming to think of it in that way, more maybe of what the molecular geneticists do in terms of using molecular biology techniques to answer questions of physiology and biology, except we're not a molecular genetics lab.
Sure. You're talking about an outlook.
Yes,
sort of
the outlook may be much more similar.
Okay.
And now, again, unlike most molecular geneticists who may be more involved with yeast or E. coli, we're involved with eukaryotic system. And I mean, this may be splitting hairs too, because I mean, I'm sure many people who study enzymes or lipids want to know what they do to their cell system.
Mm-hmm.
I think our duality comes maybe more from, in a way, pre-imposing the physiology we're interested in, which is sort of leukemia growth and differentiation, mm-hmm. on the biochemistry we're doing. Rather than say, well, we have this lipid, what does it do?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? I mean,
right, we happen to come across this great lipid and stuff, nobody else did it. Well,
what does it do? Yeah.
I mean,
we have done some of those studies. I mean, not that we haven't, but
sure.
It's never been like the overriding concern of, oh, if we find it does that, that's what we're going to be doing for the rest of our career.
I think it's all very clear.
Yeah.
You seem to be all of a sudden hesitant
as
you get.
But I've never thought of it, I guess, in terms of, how does it compare to other labs? I mean, I've always thought of it and what I want to do, mm-hmm. and how do the things we do stand up to what I want to do? Sure. That's the
grade or whatever.
That's my yardstick. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you know, am I closer to the Lefkowitz model or am I closer to the Brown and Goldstein or, you know, this and that. I guess I'm thinking along
the lines, actually, maybe I haven't approached the question right, that nobody is doing biology in a vacuum. And you read widely, and indeed, maybe I could have asked the same question about the four or five articles or the book you read or who knows, maybe it's a mathematician who's Spurgeon. Maybe it's you really, before you pass on to other worlds, want to see some real serious inroads made with cancers and leukemia, where the basic science really pays off in a much more direct fashion, and people aren't still doing retrospective studies about do we dose them at this level and this many times a day.
I think my perspective is to go after discovery of physiology at the molecular level. I think a lot of physiology has been discovered at the physiology level, at the whole animal level, the whole body level, at an organ level. Mm-hmm. But I believe a whole lot of physiology is still hidden in terms of the cellular level and subcellular level.
One would think cancer being the kind of the exemplar of how it's got to be hidden somewhere.
Yes, and cancer in a way is an opportunity to look at derangements in that physiology. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it may be one of the very last things we can crack open as a scientific community, because it's really a normal cell in disguise, and we need to understand the normal cell function to great detail, I think, before we can understand individual cancers and how they go awry. I believe that there is a lot of discovery to be made in terms of even identifying new players, new lipids or new functions for old lipids, new enzymes, new pathways. I think there are many pathways, the way elements in the cell connect to each other and communicate with each other. I think, you know, we know a few now, the MAP kinases and protein kinase C and calcium signaling and calmodulin kinases and transcription factors. We know a lot, but I think that's much less than half the story. I mean, I think that's a small fraction of what we're going to learn in the future. There's still many proteins and enzymes to discover, many DNA sequences, many lipids. But what's more important, we're going to become much more sophisticated in understanding how one component talks to the other. And only after we start building that element can we start dissecting out whole pathways in terms of taking something from A to Z. How does A talk to B, to C, to D, to E? And it's going to be even more complicated because B can talk to C and C prime, and C prime can receive a signal from B and B prime.
And if it's got the day off, then F takes over.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So it's going to be very complicated, but we have, you know, each one has to make their own contribution and slowly inch forward with that.
My next question would be to start talking about all this detail that seems to be coming. We are coming to the end of the tape, and we'll turn it off, and I think maybe we'll pick up tomorrow, but we'll talk about that once I turn this off.